socks and sweatshirts and wool socks and understanding each other precisely. Bringing each other cups of tea without having to ask. So I stayed on in Tucson for medical school instead of going to Boston as I'd planned. And I met Carlo in parasitology. Hallie, around the same time, befriended some people who ran a safe house for Central American refugees. After that, we'd have strangers in our kitchen every time of night. Kids scared senseless. People with all kinds of damage. Our life was never again idyllic. I should have seen it coming. Once, she and I had gone to see a documentary on the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which was these Americans who volunteered without our government's blessing to fight against Franco and Hitler in the Spanish Civil War. At that point in U.S. history, fascism was only maybe wrong, whereas communism was definitely. When we came home from the movie, Hallie cried. Not because of the people who gave up life and limb only to lose Spain to Franco, and not for the ones who came back and were harassed for the rest of their lives for being Reds. The tragedy for Hallie was that there might never be a cause worth risking everything for in our lifetime. She was 19 years old then, and as she lay blowing her nose and sobbing on my bed, she told me this, that there were no real causes left. Now she had one. She was off to Nicaragua, a revolution of co-op farms and literacy crusades, and so I guess she was lucky. Few people know so clearly what they want. Most people can't even think what to hope for when they throw a penny in a fountain. Almost no one really gets the chance to alter the course of human events on purpose, in the exact way they wish for it to be altered. I loved her for feeling so strongly about things. But I'd watched Doc Homer spend a lifetime ministering his solemn charity to the people of grace, and I'm not sure whose course was altered by that, other than Hallie's and mine, in a direction we grew to resent. It's true that I tried myself to go into medicine, which is considered a helping profession, but I did it for the lowest of motives. I did it to win love and to prove myself capable, not to move mountains. In my opinion, mountains don't move. They only look changed when you look down on them from a great height. Chapter 5. The Semilla Besada. I'd agreed to move into the guest house on the condition that I wasn't going to impose on Emelina's family life, but apparently her life was beyond imposition. She sent John Tucker over in the morning to fetch me for breakfast. He stood tentatively outside my screen door, unsure of what to do with all his limbs. "Mom says she'll break your face if you don't come over for breakfast." "Okay, sure," I said, following him back to the house. John Tucker was the most appealing kind of adolescent. I couldn't begin to picture the man he would soon become. Armpits and arrogance, scratching the back of his neck, throwing a baseball. Out of the question. He was wearing a cap to cover what looked like an overly enthusiastic summer haircut. "I know you don't have anything to eat over there yet," Emelina said. "Everything was closed. Yesterday was Sunday. Today you can get on your feet. JT called from El Paso and said to be sure and give you a kiss." Emelina buttered a piece of toast and handed it to Mason, who was 4, going on 5. "Glenn, don't put jam on your brother. If you want to wear plum preserves today, that's your nickel, but not Curtis's. Curdy, honey, don't hit. John Tucker, help him with that, will you?" "He called from El Paso," I prompted. "Conversations with a mother of 5 are an education in patience." "Yeah, he's in Texas. He's got to stay for an investigation. So are you going to be able to stand living in that shack?"
"It's not a shack, Em. It's nice out there. I like it."
"Cody, honey, there was goats living in there at one time. And Grammy lived there, too, before the goats. But she said she got the ague in her bones and she decided she had to move in upstairs."
Grammy was JT's mother, Viola Dominguez.
"Mom, make Glenn stop," Curtis said. Glenn, for heaven's sakes, just eat that toast and put it out of its misery. The bus is going to be here in a minute and you don't even have your shoes on.
No, but I know where they are, Glenn declared.
Well, go get them.
School doesn't start till next week, I said, alarmed that I might be wrong. I was always having dreams like that.
No, but they've got this summer thing for kids. They go up there to the river park and shoot each other with bows and arrows or something. Tomorrow's the last day. So you think you'll like it out there? We make enough noise over here to raise up the quick and the dead.
It's fine. I used to live 3 blocks from a hospital ambulance entrance. I didn't add, with a man who reattached severed body parts for a living. I buttered my toast, holding my elbows in close and keeping an eye out for wayward jam knives.
So, what kind of an investigation?
Oh, JT, he put 16 cars on the ground outside El Paso. A derailment. Nobody got hurt. Oh, shoot. John Tucker, honey, will you take the baby in the living room and watch him a minute? I can't hear myself think.
John Tucker took the baby from Emelina's lap and carried him under one arm into the next room. The baby waggled his arms and legs like a swimmer in green stretch pajamas.
Okay, Mason, sweetie, put your feet up here on my lap and I'll tie your sneakers for you.
Emelina took a gulp of coffee.
So they all had to give a urine sample. JT, the fireman, the brakeman, and some other person. I can't remember who. Maybe another engineer. It all had to happen within a half hour of the accident. The company made a very big deal out of that. JT says here they were out in some cow pasture with 16 boxcars of frozen mixed vegetables scattered from hell to breakfast, and all the damn supervisor cared about was making sure which person pissed in what jar.
The boys seemed unmoved by this off-color narrative. Having Emelina for a mother would neutralize the thrill of swear words.
You know what, though? She said, looking startled. Damn, we were just joking about drug tests the day before yesterday. Grammy made a poppy seed cake for Curtis and Glenn's birthday, and JT said, Mom!
I'm sorry, Curtis, I forgot. He doesn't want us to call him Curdy. Their actual birthday was yesterday. I wanted to hear the rest of the derailment story, but this conversational flow was akin to freeway driving in L.A. You don't back up.
Well, happy birthday, I said. You boys get handsomer every time I see you. You know that?
Curtis's ears turned red.
You can say thank you, ma'am, can't you? Cody, they've all been asking me when you were going to get here till I thought they'd turn blue in the face, and now they're acting like they were raised outside in a pen with the dogs.
That's okay. I felt a little intimidated myself. Even though I'd kept up with the family, it was inconceivable that in my absence from Grace, Emelina could have produced this whole blue-eyed tribe of human beings.
Mom, can I sleep out in the pen with Buster tonight? Mason asked.
No, sir, you can't. So when we were eating that cake, JT was saying how he'd better not have an accident on the railroad because poppy seeds show up some way on the drug test.
That's true, they would.
I reconsidered this. He'd register positive for opiates. Poppy seeds are related to heroin. Is he going to be in trouble?
No, they know it wasn't his fault. It was a sun kink or some darn thing with the rails. The drug test is just to cover their ass. You know who else was on the train? The other engineer and the brakeman were both guys we went to school with. You might remember them. Roger Bristol and Lloyd Peregrina. Lloyd lived up at White River for a while, but he's moved back.
I paid attention to my heart rate to see if it would react in any way to this information. It didn't seem to.
Aunt Cody, say something in Greece, Glenn said.
In Greek, Emelina corrected, giving me an apologetic look.
I already told them you look like a fashion model and had lived overseas. They think you know David Bowie.
Your mother exaggerates, I said. Glenn didn't seem too disappointed.
So, Em, if I'm going to live here, do I have to buy a pair of those silver loafers from the Hollywood shop?
She nodded seriously. I'm pretty sure they won't let you teach down at the high school without them.
The school bus honked outside. Okay, scoot, Emelina said. Mason, give me a kiss.
The boys stampeded out the kitchen door, all legs, leaving the baby beached on Emelina's lap. His eyes roamed anxiously around the quiet kitchen, taking in the emptiness. Emelina and I took each other in, All morning I'd felt the strange disjuncture that comes from reconnecting with your past. There's such a gulf between yourself and who you were then, but people speak to that other person and it answers. It's like having a stranger as a house guest in your skin.
So what's new? She asked.
I don't know, everything. I don't think Grace has changed, but it feels different. There's a lot I don't remember. Emelina smiled.
I know what you mean. Senility strikes.
It was an odd thing to say. Doc Homer's exact problem was that his mind had begun to roam in alarming new pastures.
I guess so, I said. Well, some things never change.
She leaned forward and said in a low voice, Grammy still collects figurines of Elvis. I had to laugh. We'd known JT's mother as children, of course. People here spent their childhoods tearing through the homes of their future in-laws. And I remembered her living room, which we used to call the Elvis Museum. She denied that the ones that were whiskey bottles were whiskey bottles. She'd always told us aftershave.
So, it's all over with Carlo, or just a vacation?
I don't know. Over, I think. It's taken me all this time to figure out he's not going to tell me the secret to a meaningful life. I was serious. I'd loved Carlo best when he provided me with guidance.
I used to think the ideal husband would be Dr. Kildare.
Carlo's an emergency room surgeon. A man that decides which way to sew a thumb back on would have a good hold on life, wouldn't you think? I just assumed it would rub off.
Gross, Emelina remarked.
I think it was his eyebrows. You know how he has those kind of arched Italian eyebrows?
No, I never got to meet him. He was always at the hospital.
That was true. He was shy. He could face new flesh wounds each day at work, but he avoided actual people.
Well, I said, he had this look. He always seemed right on the verge of saying something that would change your life. Even when he was asleep, he looked like that.
But he never did?
Nope.
It was just his eyebrows. I did miss him, or at least I missed being attached to someone in theory. Carlo had beautiful hands and a legendary sense of direction. Even when we were in Venice, where the tourist books advise you that part of the Venice experience is wandering the narrow strada until you find yourself lost, we wandered but never got lost. The man had a compass needle in his cerebral cortex. And for all that, he'd still, in the long run, declined to be the guiding star I needed, just as my father did. My father was dying on me. Emelina collected the plates and cups. She stood up and tied on an apron over her bathrobe, miraculously keeping the baby situated on her hip throughout the operation.
Well, you're no worse for the wear of 5 children in 14 years, I said, and she laughed, probably not believing it.
Emelina was noticeably pretty. That combination particular to Grace, the pale blue eyes and black hair, never failed to be arresting, no matter how many versions of it you saw. The eyes were a genetic anomaly. In the first hours after birth, the really pure specimens of Grace's gene pool were supposed to have whitish, marble-like irises. I'd seen pictures. Doc Homer had written it up for the American Journal of Genetics years ago.
And John Tucker's a teenager, I said. Are we that old?
I am. You're not. She started to clear the table with one hand.
Every minute in the presence of a child takes 7 minutes off your life.
I took the baby from her, and she said, Don't say I didn't warn you. They're your treasures, Em. You've got something to show for yourself.
Oh, yeah, I know, she said.
The baby's name was Nicholas, but nobody called him anything but the baby. I'd read somewhere that the brain organizes information in sets no larger than 4. That's why Social Security and phone numbers are subdivided. Possibly 4 children's names were the limit on parental memory. I sat in the rocker and settled nameless Nicholas on my lap, his head at my knees. My long thigh bones exactly accommodated his length. Emelina scraped toast corners into a blue enamel pail and ran a sink full of hot water.
I don't think I could stand to let Mason go off to kindergarten next year if it wasn't for the baby.
It kills you to see them grow up, but I guess it would kill you quicker if they didn't.
I remember you saying you were calling it quits after 4.
Famous last words.
While I watched her move around the kitchen, my fingers tingled with the pleasure of stroking the baby's fine black hair. It was longer by several inches than his big brother John Tucker's. Someone had taken shears to that boy with a vengeance, probably Emelina. A woman who beheaded her own chickens would cut her kid's hair herself. Emelina washed and rinsed the plates and set them into the wire rack to drain. I sat feeling useless, though Nicholas seemed comfortable and was falling asleep on my lap. When that happens, you feel them grow heavier, as if relaxation allowed them to be flooded with extra substance. A constriction ran across my lungs. I'd come close to having a baby of my own once, but I thought of it now so rarely that the notion of myself as a mother always caught me off guard. In spite of the heat outside, Emelina's dishwater was fogging the window. A little collection of potted plants stood in a row on the windowsill. Prayer plants. I was struck with a sudden forceful memory of Emelina's grandmother's house. Hallie and I called her abuelita too, though of course she was no relation. And the old woman called us the orphan girls, huérfanas. Nobody ever thought we could understand Spanish. The house had a stale old lady smell, but we loved her boxes of pretties, cast metal carts with broken wheels, lead soldiers, huge washers and carriage bolts, every species of unidentifiable metal part. Her dead husband was a blacksmith. There were also boxes of ancient dress-up clothes in satiny fabrics as brittle as paper. Our best playroom was the sunny alcove crammed with plants where we stalked lions through the parlor palms, dressed in our finery, more glamorous than Beryl Markham and the Baroness von Blixen could have managed to be in their dreams. We confronted real dangers in the form of rickety iron stands holding heavy breakable pots and fragile plants. The African violets were furred like pets, and the prayer plants had leaves like an old woman's hands, red-veined on the back, that opened wide in the sun and folded primly together in the shade. Abuelita instructed us to sit and watch them, to try and catch them in the act of closing their leaves. Hallie always waited the longest, patient for enlightenment, long after Emelina and I had returned to our rowdy diversions.
"You know, I'm so used to JT being gone," Emelina said, bringing me back. "I think he'd be underfoot if he were here. I'd give us about 10 days, then I'd probably shoot him. Husband murdering Grace, oh boy."
She seemed to be answering a question, however circumspectly, that I wasn't sure I'd asked.
"How long has he been on the railroad?"
"Just since the mine shut down, which was..." She frowned at the glass she was drying, decorated with white pigs in red bow ties.
10 years, about."
"They used to always say they'd hire up there again when the price of copper went up."
"Well, you know, that's talk. Nobody's waiting around anymore. Now it's pecans and plums, and the railroad, thank God for that. I think we could live off the orchards if the boys didn't eat like horses and outgrow their shoes every 10 days. Get this, now they're too fashion-conscious to wear each other's hand-me-downs. Remember when boys didn't give a shit what they wore? We never should have got satellite TV."
She turned around, drying her hands on her apron.
"Is that rascal gone to sleep? Thanks, Cody. I'll take him upstairs and put him down for his nap."
She lifted the baby onto her shoulder like a sack of valuable flour.
"You got big plans for today?"
"I thought I'd make an excursion into the city," I said. "Check out the dry goods at the Baptist grocery." She laughed.
"If you can wait a while, I'll go with you. Grammy can listen for the baby. She ought to be home pretty soon from her meeting."
Emelina rolled her eyes as she left the kitchen.
"Stitch and Bitch Club on Mondays, bright and early."
I stood at the window looking out at the grove of trees that ran the length of the canyon. Plum, pear, apple, and quince, I believe,
though I couldn't identify a quince tree to save my life. I only remembered the word because of the way people here pronounced it, quince, with their Spanish-influenced vowels. In the distance, I could make out white satellite dishes perched among the cacti on the red cliff, one to each house, like dogs. Well, that was something new. The sky was overcast. In the orchards on the other side of the river, I could see men working among the trees. I remembered them beating the branches with long poles, bringing down scattered showers of pecans. Frailing, that was called. In the older orchards, sometimes they had to climb up into the tallest trees to reach the upper branches with their poles. But it was too early in the year for that. Pecans didn't ripen till late fall. Hallie and I had played in this house once or twice as children, when a pair of pigeon-toed girl cousins of JT's had lived here. Now it belonged so securely to Emelina. It was hard to realize how fully life had gone on. Of course, it would. I could have stayed here or gone away as I did. It made no difference to Grace. I washed the baby's cup, running my finger around the inside rim. While the sun left the windowsill and moved on to other things, I noticed the prayer plants had closed up when I wasn't watching. They stood in a self-satisfied row, keeping their thoughts to themselves.
You keep some of the dirt on them and you just stuff them down in paper bags and keep them somewhere dark, said Lydia Galvez. Do you have a root cellar?
No, we did, but the boys got into it and figured out how to cave it in some way, Emelina said.
Well, you could put them any place dark. The bottom of a closet would do.
Lydia Galvez was the wife of John Tucker's Little League coach. I'd been introduced. We'd discussed John Tucker, baseball, and Emelina's talent for producing boys. The whole town had been betting this last one would be a girl, Lydia Galvez told me. Now they were talking about dividing gladiolus bulbs.
I've got some black, Lydia was saying. Do you have any black? I could spare you some. They're not a true black. I'd really call it purple, but they're supposed to be important.
Emelina gave me a glance, so I knew she was trying to wind things up. Our whole afternoon had gone pretty much this way. Lydia, like everyone else, had no earthly notion of what to say to me or I to them. I rarely even remembered who they were, but we were all polite, as if I were Emelina's lunatic maiden aunt. I sat down on the wall in front of the courthouse and watched myself in the plate glass window of Johnny's breakfast, which was empty at this hour. My reflection stared back, looking more alone than anything I'd seen in my life. It occurred to me that I'd never drawn a breath here without Hallie, not one I could be sure of. I was 3 when she was born. Before that, I wasn't conscious of my place in the world, so it didn't matter. Later, it mattered more than anything. Doc Homer drilled us relentlessly on how we differed from our peers in ambition, native ability, even physical constitution. The nearest thing to praise from him was, "No one else in Grace knows that," or, "You are Nolene's." We stood out like a pair of silos on a Midwestern prairie. As far as I could see, being Nolene's meant that we were impossibly long-limbed like our father and all the Nolene relatives we never got to meet. He and mother came from a part of Illinois, this is a quote, where people were reasonable and tall. The height, at least, wasn't lost on Hallie and me. We turned out to be 6 feet on average, Hallie 1 inch over, and I 1 under. In high school, they used to call us 40% of a basketball team. We didn't play sports, but they still said that. Height isn't something you can have and just let be, like nice teeth or naturally curly hair. People have this idea you have to put it to use, playing basketball, for example, or observing the weather up there. If you are a girl, they feel a particular need to point your height out to you, as if you might not have noticed. In fact, Hallie and I weren't 40% of anything. We were all there was. The image in the mirror that proves you are still here. We had exactly one sister apiece. We grew up knowing the simple arithmetic of scarcity. A sister is more precious than an eye.
You tell that daddy of yours I need a pill to get rid of my wrinkles, Lydia said loudly.
I made an effort to collect myself.
Okay.
I should have said, you don't need any such thing, or something like that, but I didn't think fast enough. I wasn't managing this first day all that well. I had a lump in my throat and longed to get back to my cottage and draw the blinds. Grace was a memory minefield. Just going into the Baptist grocery with Emelina had charged me with emotions and a hopelessness I couldn't name. I'd finished my shopping in a few minutes, and while I waited for Emelina to provision her troops for the week, I stood looking helplessly at the cans of vegetables and soup that all carried some secret mission. The grocery shelves seemed to have been stocked for the people of Grace with the care of a family fallout shelter. I was an outsider to this nurturing. When the cashier asked, "Do you need anything else?" I almost cried. I wanted to say, "I need everything you have." It was past midnight, but a cold moon blazed in the window and I couldn't sleep. I lay on my back in the little painted bed in Emelina's cottage. I hated sleeping alone. As little as there was between Carlo and me, I'd adjusted to his breathing. All my life, I'd shared a bed with somebody. First Hallie. Then, in my first years at college, I discovered an army of lovers who offered degrees of temporary insanity and short-term salvation. Then Carlo, who'd turned out to be more of the same. But companionable still. Sleeping alone seemed unnatural to me and pitiful. Something done in hospitals or when you're contagious. I'd finally reached that point of electric sleeplessness where I had to get up. I tucked my nightgown into my jeans and found my shoes out in the kitchen. I closed the door quietly and took a path that led away from the house. Not down past other houses, but straight out to the north, through Emelina's plum orchard and a grove of twisted, dead-looking apples. Every so often, peacocks called to each other across the valley. They had different cries, the shrill laugh, a guttural clucking, a whole animal language. Like roosters and children, on a full moon night, they would never settle down completely. I wanted to find the road that led up the canyon to Doc Homer's. I wasn't ready to go there yet, but I had to make sure I knew the way. I couldn't ask Emelina for directions to my own childhood home. I didn't want her to know how badly dislocated I was. I'd always had trouble recalling certain specifics of childhood, but didn't realize until now that I couldn't even recognize them at point-blank range. The things I'd done with Hallie were clear because we remembered so much for each other, I suppose. But why did I not know Mrs. Campbell in the grocery? Or Lydia Galvez, who rode our school bus, and claimed to have loaned me her handkerchief after Simon Bolivar Jones chucked me on the head with his Etch-a-Sketch on a dare. In fact, I felt like the victim of a head injury. I hoped that if I struck out now on faith, I would feel my way to Doc Comer's, the way a water witcher closes her eyes and follows her dowsing rod to find a spring. But I didn't know. I could have lost the homing instinct completely. I was on a road that looked promising anyway. I could hear the river. Why does sound travel farther at night? I had my mother's death on my mind. One of my few plain childhood memories was of that day. I was not quite three. Hallie was newborn, and I'm told I couldn't possibly remember it because I wasn't there. The picture I have in my mind is nonetheless clear. Two men in white pants handling the stretcher like a fragile, important package. The helicopter blade beating, sending out currents of air across the alfalfa field behind the hospital. This was up above the canyon in the days when they grew crops up there. The flattened down alfalfa plants showed their silvery undersides in patterns that looked like waves. The field became the ocean I'd seen in storybooks, here in the middle of the desert, like some miracle. Then the rotor slowed and stopped, setting the people in the crowd to murmuring, "What? Why?" And then the door opened and the long white bundle of my mother came out again, carried differently now, no longer an urgent matter. According to generally agreed upon history, Hallie and I were home with a babysitter. This is my problem. I clearly remember things I haven't seen, sometimes things that never happened, and draw a blank on the things I've lived through. I told Doc Comer many times that I'd seen the helicopter, and I also once insisted, to the point of tears, that I remembered being on the ship with the 9 Grasela sisters and their peacocks. For that one, he forced me to sit in my room and read the Encyclopedia Britannica. Novels were banned for a month. He said I needed to clear my mind of fictions. I made it to volume 19, driven mostly by spite, but I still remembered that trip with the Graselas. They were worried about whether the peacocks were getting enough air down in the hold of the ship. I would concede now that all these things were fabrications based on stories I'd heard. Memory is a complicated thing, a relative to truth, but not its twin. It was a fact that our mother had been terrified of flying. This part of our family history was well known in Grace. In her entire life, she never left the ground. When her health deteriorated because of a failed kidney, and a National Guard helicopter bore down from the sky to take her to Tucson, she'd explained to the men that she wasn't going to fly. When they ignored her, she just died before the helicopter could lift itself up out of the alfalfa. The big bird hovered for a minute and went away hungry. It wasn't her aversion to flight that was impressive. People in Grace didn't travel much by car, let alone by air. I think the moral of the tale, based on the way people told it, was the unsuspected force of my mother's will. Who else would have married Doc Homer, they seemed to be saying. And also, I suppose, who could have borne those unconforming girls? People never said this directly, but when we were willful, they would tell us without fail, "You didn't suck that out of your thumb." It made sense to me. I had no visual memory of a mother and could not recall any events that included her outside of the helicopter trip she declined to take. But I could remember a sense of her that was strong and ferociously loving, almost a violence of love. It was the one thing I'd had, I suppose, that Hallie never knew. As the two of us grew up quietly in the dispassionate shadow of Doc Homer's care and feeding, I tried to preserve that motherly love as best I could and pass it on. But I couldn't get it right. I was so young. And somehow, Hallie thrived anyway. The blossom of our family, like one of those miraculous fruit trees that tap into an invisible vein of nurture and bear radiant bushels of plums while the trees around it merely go on living. In Grace, in the old days, when people found one of those in their orchard, they called it the semilla besada, the seed that got kissed. Sometimes you'd run across one that people had come to and returned to in hopes of a blessing. The branches would be festooned like a Christmas tree of family tokens, a baby sock, a pair of broken reading glasses, the window envelope of a pension check. Hallie and I had a favorite besada in the old Dominguez orchard, and one cold day on the way home from school we tucked wisps of our hair into its bark, secretly. We'd hidden in the schoolyard to snip the ends off our braids and tie them up together with a pink thread unraveled from my coat button. If Doc Homer found out, he would construct some punishment to cure us of superstition. We agreed with him in principle. We were little scientists, born and bred, But children robbed of love will dwell on magic. I stopped suddenly in the center of the road, in the moon's bright light, with shadow trickling downhill from my heels like the Water Witcher's wellspring finally struck open. I'd found the right path. The road angled up out of the orchards toward the top of the canyon. The steepness of the climb felt right. I would come back in daylight and go the rest of the way to Doc Homer's, past the old helicopter landing pad up in the alfalfa field. Those fields would surely be abandoned now, like half the cropland in Arizona, salted to death by years of bad irrigation. I didn't want to go up there now and see it all under moonlight, the white soil gleaming like a boneyard. It was too much. I turned back down the road, feeling the familiar blunt pressure of old grief. Even the people who knew me well didn't know my years in grace were peculiarly bracketed by death. I'd lost a mother, and I'd lost a child. Chapter 6, The Miracle. I was 15 years old, 2 years younger than my own child would be now. I didn't think of it in those terms, losing a baby. At first, it was nothing like a baby I held inside me, only a small, impossible secret. Slowly, it grew to a force as strong and untouchable as thunder. I would be loved absolutely. But even in the last months, I never quite pictured the whole infant I might have someday held in my arms. That picture came later. The human fact of it was gone before I knew it. But evidently that word lost was somewhere in my mind because I've had thousands of dreams of losing, of literally misplacing a baby. In one of the dreams, I run along the creek bank looking among the boulders. They are large and white, and the creek is flooded, just roaring, and I know I've left a baby out there. I thrash my way through mesquite thickets, stopping often to listen, hearing nothing but the roar of the water. I feel frantic until finally I see her in the middle of the water bobbing like a Cortland apple, little and red and bright. I wade in and pull her out, and she lies naked there on the bank without so much as a surname, her umbilicus tied with a man's black shoelace such as my father might wear. I see her and think, it's a miracle she's survived. That thought is the truest part of the dream. Really, there would be nothing new or surprising about a baby being born in secret and put into a creek. But to pull one out, that would be a surprise. A newborn has no fat yet. It wouldn't float. It would sink like a stone. Lloyd Peregrina was an Apache. He took me out 4 times. Our football team was called the Apaches, but Lloyd was a real Apache, and the kind of handsome you could see coming down the road like bad news. When he first asked me, I thought he'd made a mistake or a joke, and I looked to see who was watching. Nobody was. 4 Saturdays in a row, for exactly 1 lunar month. The odds of getting pregnant out of that were predictable, but I was unfathomably naive. I was a motherless girl. I'd learned the words puberty and menarche from the Encyclopedia Britannica. The rest I learned from girls in the schoolyard who weren't even talking to me when they said what they did. Lloyd wouldn't remember. For me, it was the isolated, remarkable event of a tenuous life. But for Lloyd, Lloyd with one L, with his misspelled name and devil eyes, it was 1 in 100. He was a senior and ran around with everybody. Also, he was such a drinker in those days that I was frankly surprised to hear he was still alive. He never knew what he'd spawned, much less when it died. Even Hallie didn't. It's the first time I understood that even with a sister, I could be alone. At night, I lay feeling my limbs, seeing what Hallie still saw, which was nothing near the truth, and I felt myself growing distant and stolid. I was the woman downtown buttoning her child's jacket, her teeth like a third hand clamped on a folded grocery list, as preoccupied as God. Someone important and similar to others. I was lured and terrified. I couldn't help but think sometimes of escape. The thing inside me turning to blood of its own accord, its bones liquefying, leaking out. And then, one evening, my savage wish was granted. I never did tell Hallie. I kept quiet, first to protect her from the knowledge of terrible things, and later to protect myself from that rock-solid element she came to own, that moral advantage. It divided me from the people I knew, then and later. But in broader human terms, I don't pretend that it sets me apart in any great way. A miscarriage is a natural and common event. All told, probably more women have lost a child from this world than haven't. Most don't mention it, and they go on from day to day as if it hadn't happened. And so people imagine that a woman in this situation never really knew or loved what she had. But ask her sometime, how old would your child be now? And she'll know. Chapter 7, Poison Ground. Emelina was up with the chickens. I heard her out in the courtyard pulling honeysuckle vines away from the old brick barbecue pit. They came out with a peculiar zipping sound, like threads from a seam in rotten cloth. "You can see we haven't been festive for a while," she said. She was organizing what she called a little fiesta for the Saturday of Labor Day weekend. It was a family tradition. They roasted a whole goat. Not John Tucker's. I found a broom and pitched in, sweeping up the pieces of a broken flower pot I'd come to think of as part of the decor. Emelina asked, in the carefully offhand way a good mother would ask, if I'd been up to the school yet. I'd received numerous calls about a teacher's meeting. "I know about the meeting, but I haven't gone up there yet," I confessed. School would begin the following Tuesday. I needed to get organized and see what kind of shape the labs were in, but I kept putting it off, on grounds of terror. I hadn't actually taught school before. When Emelina wrote me about the opening at Grace High School, it had seemed sensible to apply. While Carlos slept, I'd sat up in bed with my legal pad and a small reading light, feigning competence, attempting to organize the problem areas of my life into manageable categories. I had no real attachment to selling lottery tickets at 7-Eleven. Doc Homer was going off the deep end. Carlo was Carlo. Hallie would be leaving at summer's end, and without a destination for myself, I'd be marooned. Grace was something. If I got this job, I could spend 10 months in Grace seeing about Doc Homer, possibly without his noticing. I reasoned that I wasn't qualified and didn't have a chance of being hired, and so I felt bold enough to apply. They hired me. The state had some kind of emergency clause that in a pinch allowed people to teach without certification. And of course, I did have a world of education in the life sciences. Also, I believe my last name had something to do with it. Nothing else I put down in my wobbly writing on that application could have impressed anyone too much. I dumped the shards of the flower pot into a plastic trash bag, making the satisfactory sound of demolition. I started in with Emelina on the honeysuckle vines. As we dragged them out, she looped the long strands around her arm like strings of Christmas tree lights. "You excited about starting?" she asked. "Nervous." "Well, hell, Cody, you're bound to be better than the last one. John Tucker says she was scared of her shadow. Some senior boys chased her into the teacher's lounge with a fetal pig." Emelina's faith in me was heartening. "Did I tell you JT called this morning?" she asked. "They're going to make it home for the fiesta, him and Lloyd. Do you remember Lloyd?" I yanked at a vine that was rooted right into the crumbling adobe. "Sure, I said.
I didn't know if you would. I think you were the only girl in the whole high school that never fell for him.
It was humid and hot. I'd tied a bandana around my forehead, and already it was soaking wet. The salt stung my eyes. I said, I went out with Lloyd a few times.
Did you? Him and JT are real good buddies. He straightened out a lot. He's real sweet.
She unburdened herself of the loops of vines, laying them in a pile, and stood up with her hands on her waist, arching her back.
Lloyd, I mean, she laughed. Not JT. He's just the same as he always was.
I took off my bandana and wrung it out. The dark drops on the hot brick dried up instantly, leaving behind a white lace of salt, just like the irrigation water on the alfalfa. In just this way, the fields get ruined, I thought to myself. Emelina kicked tentatively at the brick barbecue pit.
You think this thing will stand up after we get the vines out of it?
I think they're what's holding it together, I said. She cocked her head and looked at it thoughtfully.
Well, if it falls down, we'll just have us a roasted goat disaster. We'll just have to get extra beer.
On the morning of the fiesta, she sent John Tucker and me to town for last-minute supplies, including extra beer, although the barbecue pit showed every sign of standing through another Labor Day fiesta. I followed John Tucker down a path I didn't know, a shortcut through a different orchard. What kind of trees are those? I asked John Tucker. The branches were heavy with what looked like small yellow-green pomegranates.
Quince, he said, with a perfect short eye, not quince.
The Spanish-flavored accent of Old Grace was dying out, thanks to satellite TV, I suppose. I watched the back of his shorn head. The path was narrow, and we walked single file. At 13, he was my height, a head taller than Emelina. It must shift your liaison with a child when you have to look up to him. I caught a glimpse of bright car windshield through the trees and knew where we were. You could picture Grace as a house with orchards for rooms. To map it, of course, you'd have to be a botanist. We left Quince and entered Pecan, where the ground was covered with tiny, immature nuts.
So what's happening with these orchards? I asked, kicking at a slew of green pecans the size of peach pits. I've been seeing this all over.
Fruit drop. John Tucker was already a man of few words. The Baptist grocery was non-denominational, but harked back to a time when everything in Grace, including grocery stores, was still segregated. This wasn't recent, but maybe a century ago. Here, the Hispanic and Anglo bloodlines got very mixed up early on, starting with the arrival of the Gracela sisters. By the time people elsewhere were waking up to such ideas as busing, everyone in Grace had pretty much given up on claiming a superior pedigree. Nowadays, the Baptist grocery peddled frozen fish sticks to Protestant and Catholic alike. John Tucker shopped like an automaton, counting out bags of chips and jars of salsa. Since he seemed interested in efficiency, not congeniality, I suggested we split up. I would go to the liquor store and meet him in front of the courthouse. Drinking establishments had proliferated in Grace since my day. The mine had closed in the interim, of course. Bars and economic duress are common fellow travelers. I passed the Horny Toad Saloon and the Little Dipper, plus the one I remembered, the State Line, which was no more situated on the state line than the grocery was Baptist. New Mexico lay 30 miles to the east. I think the name referred to the days when Gracela County was dry and people had to drive to the border for beer. Emelina had advised that I'd find the best price on beer at the Watering Hole, a package store. I located it on the corner of Main and the Depot Alley, which led down past the old movie theater to the railroad station. The theater had been remodeled into an exercise salon and video rental store called the Video Rodeo, with a huge hand-lettered sign in the window announcing, Nintendo's Nowhere. I stared for a good half minute before I made out that it meant, Now Here, not Nowhere. the calligrapher got cramped. The watering hole was closed, with a sign on the door saying back in 10, so I waited. The placard was lettered in the same hand as the Nintendo sign. Maybe one person actually ran all the stores in Grace from behind the scenes, like the Wizard of Oz, powerfully manipulating people through hand-lettered signs. It was hot, and my mind was fraying at the edges. I wiped the sweat out of my eyes and massaged my prickly scalp, thinking I must look like a drowned hen, but maybe nobody would recognize me today. Living without a lover was beginning to produce in me the odd sense that I was invisible. A pretty old carob tree stood near the door of the liquor store, throwing dappled shade on the sidewalk. I knew that its twisted, woody-looking pods could be crunched between the teeth and tasted like cocoa. I sat on a concrete block and leaned my back against the trunk. Apparently, this was a frequent waiting spot. Fallen carob pods lay all around my feet. I picked one up, polished it on my t-shirt, and bit down. The first sensation was sawdust, but then the splinters turned strongly bittersweet on my tongue, a nostalgic tang. I looked up into the leathery leaves. Hallie had told me carobs were dioecious, which means that male and female parts are possessed by separate individuals. In plain English, they're like us. It takes two to tango. This one was loaded with fruit, but there wasn't another carob tree in sight. I looked all the way down the main street and down towards the depot. No male carobs. I patted the trunk sympathetically. The door of the watering hole was opened by a proprietor who looked as if she might not be legal drinking age herself. In fact, this must have been the case, because after she bagged and rang up my purchase, she asked if I'd mind waiting while she went next door to the video rodeo and got her dad. He arrived shortly to accept my money and put it in the register. I suppose they switched off, since she probably wasn't old enough to rent out porno movies either. I recognized neither father nor daughter, and they didn't make a point of knowing or not knowing me. A relief. The daily work of re-meeting people was overwhelming, and Emelina's party was going to be a whole lot more of the same. I took my paper bags and headed across the street. A red pickup truck beeped its horn and startled me. I had charged right across without looking. I froze up like one of those ridiculous squirrels that dart one way and then the other and are doomed to end up roadkill. Except my life was in no danger here. He'd stopped. It was Lloyd Peregrina, looking exactly like himself. If anything, he looked younger than 15 years ago. His arm was out the window, and I hurried out of his way, thinking it was a turn signal, that he was trying to turn right. It didn't occur to me till he'd gone on down the street that he was waving at me. I stayed in the shower forever, trying to rinse the salt out of my scalp and skin. I had fantasies of not going to this thing, but Emelina would be hurt. And also my house sat in the middle of the party like a floral centerpiece. It would be hard to pretend not to be home. I put on the most minimal thing I owned, a white cotton dress, and sneaked out my front door. It was like a high school reunion. Everyone was boisterously friendly and dying to be filled in on the last decade and a half, which in my case was not that pretty a picture, and of course they asked about Hallie. Children ran underfoot like rebel cockroaches. Emelina, my guardian angel, kept setting me up in conversations before running off to clean up some mess the kids had gotten into or check on the goat. JT came over and gave me a hug that lifted me off the ground, but that's JT plus a few beers. It really was nice to see him. "I hear you wrecked a train," I said. "Wrecked her good," he said. JT was broad-shouldered and dark, with the kind of face that's made more handsome, not less, by the scars of teenage acne. We'd known each other since we were babies. His older sister, Pocha, was at the party, and his brothers, Cristobal, Gus, and Arturo, all of whom had been our neighbors when Hallie and I were small. I remembered playing Dutchman's Tag with them at the graveyard on All Souls Day. It was always a huge family picnic up there, until Doc Homer decided the graveyard was off limits. Bird mites, no doubt. People were jammed into the courtyard, belly to elbow, and it soon got too noisy to talk. I stood near the edge of things, in the shade of an olive that was probably planted when the house was built, middle-aged as olives go. A band called the Stingrays, featuring one of JT's formerly pigeon-toed cousins, was belting out Rosalie. I spotted Lloyd across the way, but would have had to step on 100 toes to get to him. He was leaning against the wall with his arms crossed, paying attention to a small woman in a strapless dress. Lloyd looked like someone in a cigarette ad, except he wasn't smoking. White t-shirt, white smile. Those models are always the picture of health. His hair was mink black in a ponytail, and he had terrific arms. I hate to admit things like this, but in a certain frame of mind, I am a sucker for good muscle definition. A woman approached me suddenly from behind and shouted, "Cody Nolene, God, honey, you look like a rock and roll star." In my sundress and dime store thongs, I looked no more like a rock and roll star than Mother Teresa. "I'll take that as a compliment," I said. "I take them where I can get them nowadays." "Lord, I know what you mean," she said. It was Trish Garcia, who was a cheerleader and clandestine smoker when I'd last known her. Now she smoked openly, had a raspy cough, and looked like a cartwheel was out of the question. "I heard Hallie's in South Africa." I laughed. "Nicaragua." "Well, what in the world's she doing there?" In high school, Hallie and I were beneath Trish's stratum of normal conversation. I remembered every day of those years. No lapses there. Once in the bathroom, I'd heard her call us the Beanpole Sisters and speculate that we wore hand-me-down underwear. I wondered how the rules had changed. Had I come up in the world or Trish down? Or perhaps growing up meant we put our knives away and feigned ignorance of the damage. I said, "Hallie's teaching people how to grow crops without wrecking the soil. She has her master's in integrated pest management." Trish looked indifferent, but she was working hard at being unimpressed, whereas before it came naturally. I took this as a good sign. "Well, I guess it pays good," she said. "No, they're not really paying her. Just living expenses is about all, I think. She's doing it just to do it. She wants to be part of a new society." Trish stared. I pretended Hallie was there at the party somewhere, about to walk up behind me. 6 or 7 years ago, I said, "they threw out the dictator and gave all his land to the poor people. But they need a lot of help in the farming department now because these soldiers keep attacking the poor farmers from across the border and burning their crops." Hallie would laugh at farming department. She'd laugh at the whole scene, the education of Trish the cheerleader. She would love me. "The communists," Trish said knowingly. "I heard about that. I heard they're thinking about sending the Marines down there to stop them from doing that." "No, it's the other way around," I said patiently. "The Marines aren't rooting for the new society. The U.S. is paying the Contras, the guys that attack the farmers." Hallie would not laugh now. She would be inflamed. She said we were a nation in love with forgetting the facts. She saved clippings that proved it. When Castro released those prisoners from Mariel, one day the headline said we'd gotten him to free all these wonderful political prisoners. A month later, when they were burning down halfway houses in Miami, the papers castigated Fidel for exporting his hooligans and junkies. Trish fiddled with her bra strap. "Hallie always would just up and do anything under the blue sky," she said. "You're right," I told Trish. "I wish I were that brave. I'd be scared to death to be where she is." "Well, you know, we can't all be the hero," she said, jutting out her lower jaw to blow smoke up toward the olive branches. If I could have drawn blood, if I'd known how to do that with words instead of a needle, I would have. I wasn't sure what Hallie craved, but I knew it wasn't glory. "How's Doc Homer?" she asked. I hadn't yet found the valor to go see him. I feared seeing him in failing condition and still disapproving of me on top of it. I said, "Hard to say. I felt a tap on my shoulder and turned to see Lloyd grinning broadly. Too good to speak to an Indian boy on Main Street? The tingle of a blush started behind my ears.